I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Pasher Mala joins me now. His new novel, Fugue States, has just been published. In the book, Ash, a young man who hosts a literary radio program, is grieving the death of his father. With his best friend, Matt, they embark on a journey from here to Kashmir, India. Ash finds a half-completed work of fiction of his father's, and Matt and Ash proceed to his father's ancestral home. There are many themes in this book, ones I'll discuss with Mr. Mala. The idea of looking for one's roots, the relationship between father and son, the close bond of friendship between guys, and the narrative that yields. I'll ask Pasher Mala about what he might want the reader to think about, as well as what he's thinking about having written this book. Pasher Mala is the award-winning writer of the acclaimed short story collection The Withdrawal Method, which received a number of awards, including the Trillium Book Award. His first novel, People Park, was shortlisted for the Amazon.ca First Novel Award. He has received the Arthur Ellis Award for Crime Fiction and two National Newspaper Awards. Fugue States is published by Knopf. He lives in Toronto, but joined me from here in Vancouver last week while in town for an appearance. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Pasher Mala. Mr. Mala, good morning.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. How is this, because I've never read any of your books until I started Fugue States. How is this different from your previous writing?
It's totally different. I sort of feel that each book is in some way a reaction to the previous one, and the one previous to this, at least the novel, this novel People Park that came out in 2012, was a massive 37 characters and set in an invented place, and it was kind of magic realist, I suppose, and had a whole different set of concerns and techniques and strategies, and I had maps all over my office and charts and things like that, and this was an attempt to try and write about a real place or real places and based on people I know and trying to tell a story that was a bit closer to me personally. So in just the material alone and the approach to it, it was a total departure from anything I've done before. And the strategies kind of going in were much more realist, and I think the models I was looking at for novels were kind of realist, character-driven, narrative fiction. And, I mean, that kind of got derailed by the book and what I wanted to do with the book, but certainly those were my kind of models going in.
So I'm interested to know, when you start a project like this, do you have in mind what you want to accomplish? And by that I mean, do you have the full scope of what you want to do? And does that change at all between then and the book that's between these covers?
Yeah, this novel, it's funny. I was just looking through old emails this morning, and I have been telling people that this book started in 2011, but I realized that I first started putting grant proposals for it together in 2008. Mm. And the book that I was proposing at the time was not this at all. It was really just a story about this Amarnath pilgrimage. And then it sort of went from there into looking at my relationship with my dad a little bit. And then trying to figure out how to change a bunch of stuff so I could look at it from a kind of fictional perspective. So it started as something that has become a tiny kernel in the book. And then even, later into drafts, it was a book in three parts, and I had the first two parts written, and then I went to India thinking that I would get everything I needed there to write the third part, and then what I found once I got there and the kinds of situations that I found myself in and the conversations I was having completely derailed what I thought that third part was going to be, so I had to kind of redo the first two parts and then reimagine how the book was going to end. So, yeah, it changed a lot, and I find this is kind of the way that I seem to work, is that if I have any kind of plan, the plan mostly kind of gets reinvented as I go.
Now, Ash and his father, what sort of relationship do they have? Because at the beginning of the book, we find out that Ash's dad has died. Mm-hmm. But before that, would you tell us how they react to one another, say?
It's sort of hinted at through stories as the book progresses, these kinds of moments from the past. And, what it becomes to Ash is, this eulogy that he's delivering starts to feel false, and then within the grieving process and with his sister and with his friend and sort of other people around them, he starts to, you know, recall stories about his dad and these sorts of stories that become the kind of keystone stories that we tell about people. And then trying to figure out if there was some truth in those stories, like if there is, if those are just a characterization of his father or if there's something kind of essential about him. And their relationship, I think, prior to his father passing away is kind of hinted at toward the end of the book, where you haven't gotten yet.
No.
But there's a kind of long scene near the end of the book of the last time that they saw each other. And I think that it kind of resets the book and kind of brings you back to the beginning because it's what happened before the eulogy.
Yeah.
So that gives a kind of a better indication of what things were like between them. It's kind of this, Ali Smith, the Scottish writer, she has this great story called True Story or Long Story Short, I can't remember what it is. And it starts with her sort of observing a father and son, and she describes their relationship as a kind of practiced diffidence, the son to the father.
Yeah.
And I like that phrase, and it was something that sort of informed the way that I thought of these two guys, who don't share a lot of scenes in the book, just because the father is dead.
Yeah. Well, do you think because I'm a son too? Do you think people that you know, friends, say, or colleagues, or people you encounter, do you think they think about this relationship between themselves and their fathers a great deal?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with friends, you know, male friends, and about their relationships with their dads, and they're all, you know, very different relationships from, you know, some who have never met their fathers to others who are, like, you know, talk to their dads every day, and so I don't know if there's anything common between them, though in the book there's, like, you know, there's some moments where characters sort of share, you know, someone sneezes at one point, it's like, oh my god, I sneezed just like my dad, and there are these kind of gestures and this kind of inheritance that turns up in ways that we can't control that I think is kind of interesting sometimes. And I mean, I think that happens with sons and moms and daughters and moms and whoever, you know, whoever your parents are, but and I don't know if it's more acute because of the similarity in gender or whatever, like you feel like you're some sort of echo of your parent. But, yeah, that's definitely something that's come up with friends of mine who at least have relationships with their dads or knew their dads, is that, like, these little glimpses of their dads in themselves as they get older. Like, my dad and I sweat the same way, like, in the same sort of sweat patterns, which I remember when it started happening in kind of my early 30s, like, oh, my God, like, I have this big, you know, circle of sweat in the middle of my chest. I was like, I don't want to sweat like my dad. It was something I thought was gross as a kid.
So
I think these are, like, things that we can't really control are interesting, you know, that whatever, if they're sort of learned behaviors or kind of coded into genetics, I have no idea. I mean, sweat, obviously, is not something I could control.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I like thinking about these little things, like these little inheritances.
So it's one thing to say, look or do things like a parent, but the sort of reaching that you do in this book to one's roots or the connection to one's heritage, is that something that people do a lot? And I wonder this because I talk to authors all the time and you know, documentarians and artistic people who say write plays about family and the sort, and I wonder most of the time they say that people don't do this enough, and so they do it because they're looking for something or trying to understand themselves as they get older.
And I mean, I think that process and that project is something this book really calls into question, the kind of instincts behind that. I mean, it seems like a very new world phenomenon to me that those of us who kind of aren't participating in a kind of living history all the time, as you might in somewhere like India, maybe are seeking these things more than people who have that access to history kind of all around them. So I wonder a little bit sometimes about people who grow up detached from the culture of one of their parents or both of their parents, trying to reattach to that culture and then find some identity, some sort of, you know, innate genetic identity or something in that. Like, I don't know that it's wrong. I know for me in working in this book, it was sort of the questions, at least the character sort of questions that process, is like, what am I actually going to find? Am I just going to create a new story that might be just as fictional as as any other, or is there something? Is there something kind of innate in that? That it's some kind of innate truth about who we are. So that's like, you know, that the project you're kind of describing is something the book, you know, questions, yeah, and challenges and troubles a little bit.
So then, was it inevitable for you to want to do the same for yourself?
Yeah, and no. I mean, I did go to Kashmir while I was working on this book, and it was not a kind of birthright homecoming trip where I suddenly, you know, understood who I was. Like, mm-hmm, I found it very alienating, and it's a place that I hadn't been since I was four. So I have, you know, almost no memory of it, and it had kind of existed, as it does for the character, in stories from the family. And the character in the book, you know, talks a lot about this kind of idealization he grew up with, you know, from his father, that Kashmir is the most beautiful place in the world, and, you know, it was a place of peace before the whole situation was hijacked, and so he's reluctant to go because he's afraid that, you know, those ideas and those kinds of stories will prove to be false, like, as he feels also like the stories that he has about his father are not kind of getting to something essential about him. So yeah, that was, it's, you know, it's important to the character's eventual journey that it's a reluctant journey. Like, he doesn't actually think that he's going to get anything out of it.
The relationship with Matt, his friend, were they close growing up? I mean, how does this relationship, because we see them at the beginning of the book, and I was going to say they were close, but they seem close, but whether they're close or not, I guess that'll evolve throughout the book. But how did they meet, say?
Yeah, I mean, there's they kind of got met when they were 10, and there's some line about in the book about, you know, when you're 10, all you need to have in common is, like, you know, divorced parents and the love for sports and your best friends for life, sort of thing. So, and, you know, as they've grown up and grown apart and developed very different adult lives, this kind of tether between them has become strained. And Ash kind of views it as, like, you know, we're different now. The past is the past. It's behind us. And Matt is very much clinging to it and still feels like they have this connection that will never be broken because they're best friends for life. So they're kind of at odds a little bit within the friendship as to, you know, each other's roles in each other's lives. And, you know, the book, as we're kind of introduced, is Matt has kind of imposed himself on Ash's life in the middle of the funeral, in the middle of this kind of period of grief after his dad dies. So, and then it kind of, the relationship develops from there. Like, it sort of changes over the course of the book as well.
Is there something about friendship, especially the male kind of friendship that one has, that you've learned about, say, or know something more about after having written this book?
Not really. I mean, I'm actually, we'll see, because the, you know, Matt is a character that is a, you know, an absurd. I've called him like a grotesque Megatron of a bunch of friends that I grew up with in London, Ontario. Like, kind of many of their worst qualities kind of transposed into this one guy. And a few of them, you know, are now reading it or have read it. So their responses and sort of how they are, you know, how they're reading that character and what they understand about him has been kind of interesting. And I'm kind of looking forward to having those conversations because, you know, the Ash character is, you know, identifiable. How should I put this? We share qualities, and he is also a kind of caricature of another kind of masculinity. But I think that friends of mine would sort of recognize things about me in that character, and then these friends would sort of recognize, some of them may recognize things about themselves. So I'm interested in having those conversations, and I've certainly had a few already. And, you know, one friend of mine named Matt said that he found the book really difficult. I mean, ultimately, like, he thought the things that it sort of forced him to think about were good and beneficial, yeah, and he's glad that he did, but he said it, you know, a few times it was a real struggle for him to sort of confront things about himself that were in the book and in the character.
Is the character of Matt and all these qualities that he has, these awful qualities that he has, is that reflective, do you think, of sort of the men that certain people may have encountered in their life?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Like, women readers, do they come up to you and say they've seen that guy or they know that guy, say?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I think this is he's an archetype, right? He's a caricature, but he's also a kind of archetype of a certain type of person. So I think, you know, in fiction, you know, a realistic depiction of a character like that is less effective than a kind of blown-up, grotesque version, that we get all those qualities kind of writ large on the page. So I don't think that he is literally like, I hope he's literally like nobody.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there are things that he does and things that he says that might be identifiable and familiar to people. He's a kind of Canadian guy, you know. And he thinks he's well-meaning and well-intentioned and harmless, but I think ultimately, because you know, as that sort of unravels over the course of the book, it's, his behavior has become more and more destructive and kind of beyond his control. Like, I don't blame that character for acting the way he does. I feel like he's kind of trapped in a narrative of his own that's created an identity that he can't realize, or he can't sort of ever get who he really is amid all these expectations of him. Culturally, as a guy, as a white guy.
When you create the character of Ash, and you said a moment ago that friends of yours see traits of his in you, and vice versa, I guess. The one aspect that might be, I guess writ home is the writer that Ash is.
Mm-hmm.
I guess his job at the moment is he's a radio host, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he did have an earlier novel. Was that a success?
His novel was, and I think that his struggle is that he feels that novel is kind of disingenuous to who he is, and people have read the novel thinking that the character in his novel is him, and they really like the character, and they like things about the character that are not true of Ash himself. So he has, you know, kind of tried to distance himself from this book and has never written anything else since because he feels like he kind of sold himself out a little bit. So, yeah, the book did relatively well. It did well enough for him to, you know, get this job on the radio interviewing authors. But he has not been able to write anything else despite intentions to write. You know, his next book was allegedly going to be about Kashmir, and he's never been able to do it.
And he encounters readers of that first book along the way, right?
Yes. And there's a scene with a book club. Yeah.
Is that similar to some experience that you might have had?
The book club experience, no, not in the. I mean, I've been to book clubs, and some of them have been amazing, and some of them have been a little less so.
Uh-huh.
But the experience he has at the book club is nothing like anything that's ever happened to me, no.
What I'm curious to, because you've written a lot. You've written short stories and the sort. Well, when you talk to readers of your work, and they have, say, conclusions about the characters or what you mean, what does that feel like when you've spent a lot of time with this writing, obviously.
Yeah.
When you hear what other people are saying, and maybe it's not exactly how you thought it would be or it turned out.
I think, you know, you can't control what readers think, and, you know, part of the beauty of a book is, you know, one hopes that there are all kinds of paths into it for all kinds of different people, and that people will have different experiences of it. But, you know, a lot of the things in this book are based in archetype, based in cliche, based in certain tropes, and in order to kind of undo them and look at, you know, where they come from and what the results are. So I hope that the kind of reader that I value and feel lucky to encounter is one who reads the book, you know, feeling that there's a lot of intentionality in what the book is doing, and that much of what's in the book is done for a reason. And then I hope that readers would read it actively and sort of think about what the reasons might be, that this obnoxious, racist, misogynist, destructive, violent character is, I'm not, you know, I don't think he's great. Like, the way that he is in the book is in there for a reason, and that, you know, most of what's in the book is stuff that I've thought through and, you know, conscientiously including in ways to, you know, give the book a kind of meaning. And the book is, I think of it as a kind of parody, not in that it's like a farce or a satire or anything like that, but that it's taking a form and sort of inverting the form a little bit. Like, it sort of sets itself up as a kind of, you know, quest novel, realist novel with characters, like a character returning to the homeland, and with this kind of inheritance, and trying to sort of complete a story. And ultimately, I'm trying to expose that whole structure is kind of problematic. So I, you know, it would be nice to think that, and I realize people are busy and reading is a lot of work already, but I get excited when I meet a reader who has read the book and really kind of thought through all those choices and considered why the book might be doing some of the things that it's doing.
So then, do you write it? Do you write a book like Fugue Stakes to want to say change the sort of narratives that we've fallen into or that we say, rely on?
I don't know if books are able to do that, or certainly one book is not. But I it would be nice if it sort of maybe forces people to question a certain type of storytelling and a certain type of set of expectations, I guess, for the way certain stories are told, and that there might be other ways to tell them, and, you know, the limitations of how, for example, children of immigrants are meant to sort of tell their stories is not allowing for a kind of multiplicity of voices. And this book, I hope, kind of exposes that a little bit and maybe kind of offers an alternative. And it would be nice if that set of questions was kind of could be transposed to things outside literature. Like, it's, you know, it's nice to question the form of books, but like, what does that, you know, I hope the book asks of readers to sort of wonder what that does in the culture at large. Like, if, you know, our cultural discourse, if literature is part of our cultural discourse, like, what, you know, what are these books who sort of operate in the same way under a set of expectations, what are they doing to that discourse? Like, how are they limiting it? So, yeah, I don't know if having goals for the book is fair, but I don't think a book can change much, but I think it can get people to think about things.
So I looked you up on Twitter last night.
Not on there.
No, you're not. But people have been tweeting about you, and I see that you've been traveling a great deal. By the way, when you're traveling, are you able to write at all?
No, yeah. Not at all.
So when do you have to carve time out of your day? Say, because I know you have a job. Do you have to carve time out of your day to sit down and write?
Yeah, and it's been a while since I've actually had much time or blocks of time to really work on something. I do have a new book kind of in the early stages, and I haven't had much time to sit down and really work on it. So I'm hoping in the last couple weeks of July and maybe into August I'll have some time to sort of dedicate to just working on this new project.
And when you're on book tour and you talk to readers, does any the feedback that they give you for this book or previous books, does that influence how you write in the future?
Well, the one thing that I really like is that, you know, I get to have conversations like this. I just did a radio interview at Roundhouse Radio this morning. And it's just nice to, you know, writing is lonely. You know, you're alone in a room, you put this thing out in the world, and it feels a bit like an echo chamber, and you kind of wait for the echo to come back. So it's nice to have conversations with people who now have this stuff that's in the book in their head, too. So I just like the interaction, the chance to be a little bit more social than a kind of lonely writer sitting in a room typing. I don't know that if I'm aware of how these conversations might influence how I approach the next project. It may be a bit more subliminal than I'm aware of, but it's not like I, you know, return home and I'm like, okay, I did that interview and this person said that and I should think about the next time I write. But I would imagine that a lot of this stuff seeps in ways that I'm not aware of.
So the one thing I saw on Twitter about you that interested me was one of these magazines, these literary things, took a picture of your desk.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Is that where you work on?
Yeah, that's where I work at Hamilton at our house, yeah.
Yeah. Now, there's a poster on the wall for The Big Lebowski.
Yeah, in Italian.
I've never seen that movie. Should I?
Yeah, it's great. It's fun. It's stupid. Yeah, it's super entertaining and wacky, and yeah, you should.
Yeah, because I hear people talking about it all the time, making references to it. I mean, I know the references now more than I know, say, the movie, because I've never seen it.
Yeah.
And I'm just, so is it one that's a favorite for you? That's why you have it so
prominent? That was a present from some people who went to this art show, and there were all kinds. It was like a Big Lebowski art show, and they had these Italian posters, these hand-drawn posters from the movie, and they got it for me. And I don't think I'd ever expressed anything to them before that I really liked that movie. Though I did have one birthday party at a bowling alley that was Big Lebowski themed, because there's a lot of bowling in it.
Yeah.
But it's fun. I mean, I feel like, you know, it's not a masterpiece or anything. It's just like a really entertaining, interesting, kind of weird and wacky movie.
Yeah, because I mean, I hear people reference it all the time, and
it's
one of these things where, well, it must be good if people like it.
Yeah, you know? I mean, it's Coen Brothers movies aren't for everybody, but it's certainly, it's kind of developed. I mean, at this stage, it doesn't even feel like a cult following. It's like a massive kind of cultural movement behind it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a fun movie. I really like it.
Yeah, well, I'll pick it up at the video store after I read this book. By the way, when we were just talking about film, I just got thinking. Do you think that has had an influence on writers like yourself? Because I'm assuming you grew up watching films more than before reading, I should say.
Well, reading more than before movies, for sure, as a little kid. And then, you know, the thing I worry about a little bit is that, you know, the codes of screenwriting have been kind of transmuted to the codes of writing books. And, you know, the writer's toolkit in fiction is much more vast than the screenwriter's toolkit. Like, we can use, you know, all five senses, for example. You can have smells and tastes and sensation in a novel, and you can't really convey that in a screenplay. It's something that you engage with voyeuristically. So I worry sometimes that, you know, cinema's influence on how novels are written is kind of limiting writers, and I feel like there's a lot of advice now that writers are getting, like this show don't tell thing people say, that is good advice for screenwriters. But, you know, one of the nice things about a novel is you can spend a paragraph inside a character's head kind of exploring their feelings and their thoughts and things like that. So, you know, I like books that use the whole fiction writer's toolkit as opposed to the screenwriter's toolkit. If I want to watch a movie, I'll watch a movie. I read a book because books do all kinds of things movies can't.
Yeah, I was just thinking because I'm wrapping up for the summer and looking back at the last year or so since September of interviews that I've done, how many books, be they fiction or nonfiction, you know, are just coming out and are already optioned. And I'm thinking to myself as I'm talking to some of these writers, how they may have written it with that in mind, or that was the goal.
Yeah, you never know, right? Like, I don't know about writers' intentions if people have that, you know, have that thought in their head while they're writing a book. I mean, it's certainly not one that I care about.
Yeah. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I can't wait to finish this book, and I will get The Big Lebowski, definitely.
Yeah, you should. It's fun.
Yeah, thanks for this, and continued good luck with it.
Yeah, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
The book is called Fugue States. It's published by Knopf. Its author, Pasha Mallow, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.